And we're going to begin. So we are studying here Judaism and the isms. And we have arrived at a pretty hefty, complex, complicated, important, relevant topic. And that is Judaism encounters, we'll call it a double topic of feminism and egalitarianism. Okay. This is one of the thorniest challenges that Judaism faces today. And this is just the beginning. We're going to do this in a number of different classes, okay? Because there's so much here, and we have to try to make sense of it. So what I did for tonight is I created a source sheet, which I'm going to share now. Put this on share, okay? And so share screen. Matan, Judaism encounters feminism. Does everybody see this source sheet over here?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Fantastic. So everybody sees this short source sheet. And what we're going to try to do tonight is, well, first of all, we have to define what feminism is, which we're going to use Wikipedia for this. We could spend from now to Wazoo figuring out what feminism is, and there are different parts of feminism, different aspects of feminist theory, different stages in feminism. And, but we will try to get a general picture of what it is. And then we're going to try to identify, well, what exactly is the challenge between the ideology of feminism versus Judaism? Okay, so we have to identify the problem. Once we identify the challenges and what the problem indeed is, then we're going to start looking at feminism in early Jewish history, in Tanakh, in the time of the Gemara. And finally, we're going to try to address the fundamental question tonight of whether women can become men. Okay, can women become men? I'm not talking about this from a biological or a surgical standpoint about transgenders. I'm talking about halachically, can women take the status of men and become obligated in all the mitzvot? So what we're going to try to do essentially is try to figure out. Let's start from the beginning. Let's first of all start out, what is feminism? I'd like to hear from you. Tell me, what does feminism posit as an ideology, as a movement, historically? Please tell me what you think.
Well, historically, it was an attempt by women to be seen as equal, to have equal rights, to have the vote. It went on from there to getting equal pay for the same job, for being recognized as not half a human being, as we saw in last week's parasha, right at the very end, that in the Torah, the men are valued at so many whatevers, and the women are valued at much less.
For everything. Okay.
Essentially, the very simplest definition of feminism is to try and acquire some kind of equality.
Equality. So that's the key word. Feminism is about creating equality between men and women, that just like men can vote, women should be able to vote. Just like men get paid a certain salary in the workforce, women should get paid a certain salary in the workforce. And this also means that the same standards of treatment, of behavior, that just like men shouldn't be abused or mistreated, or so women shouldn't be in the workforce in any other context. Okay. What else? Any other aspects of feminism
I'm just thinking that women shouldn't be told what they needed to do by men. Hmm. I mean, going way back to biblical times.
Okay. So let's say it's about free will, in a sense, freedom. And mm-hmm. women can, you know, do as they please, and this could play out in marriage as well, that you know, the wife has as much of a say about big decisions as a husband might in the home.
And not being punished.
Okay, nachon. Or having the freedom to choose what type of lifestyle they want to live, and what type of marriages they want to build, or, you know, without being told what that is. Okay. Anything else? Anything else that comes to mind?
In biblical times and ancient times, women were owned. They belonged to their husband and right, to their husband's family and to the clan, and they were literally owned. And if you own something, you can deal with that something in the way you see fit.
And they were property.
It was the norm. Okay. But women were the property of their men.
Okay, so now we're getting, that's jumping to the Bible for a second, Marilyn. But first, we're just trying to identify what feminism says and believes. Today, you know, I guess feminism, you know, the Me Too movement, for example, is another iteration of the feminist movement, which is something that we're all now. Okay, so let me ask you, just I'll throw this out as a question. Do you think Judaism values the progress that feminism has brought to the world in the last 100 years?
Yes and no. The yes is that I think women's the double wages has been very much appreciated, especially in this times. But otherwise, no, Judaism doesn't. There's still many restrictions on women as to what they can and can't do.
Okay. So you're saying, you know, maybe economically, everyone likes for their wife to make as much as. You know, more money, but halachically, you're saying there's still some differences.
Yep.
Okay. What else? Any? Are there any other aspects of feminism besides for the economic benefits that Judaism values, supports, agrees with?
Well, I think the issue of Agonot, which still has not been resolved.
That's what absolutely. I was thinking. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's an example, Don, of something of a tension, right? Of what we would say is a conflict. Okay, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
I would also say that the view among certain sections of Orthodox people puts more of a value now on female education, realizing that one, the woman is many times at home with the children and she should be knowledgeable so she can help them and teach them. You can't always wait for the husband to return home from work. Mm-hmm. Or even if you are working, you still should be of a certain level where you're aware of what your responsibilities are and what the Jewish viewpoint is on it.
Uh-huh, okay.
Plus education, if you want to, you talked about equal pay, but first you have to many times give yourself a profession so you can get equal pay.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so let's just identify, at least from a halachic standpoint, the outstanding ways in which men and women are treated differently from a halachic standpoint. Okay, and I want to sort of just, you know, just identify what things are on this list. So, you know, what comes to mind, for example, when we think about some differences. What are key halachic differences between men and women? Okay, women do not count and for minyan. Correct. That's number one. What else?
Women can't count for a minyan.
No, that's like kaddish.
Yeah, we have to sit behind the mechitza in shul.
Okay, sitting behind the mechitza. Okay.
A woman can't marry a man. A man has to marry the woman.
Okay,
the man
is the one who activates the marriage and the divorce, although that's not 100% true because a woman still needs to receive these things, right? A woman doesn't take the ring, she's not married either. But it's the man who is mikadesh her, let's say. He's the one who you know, actively betroths her.
Owns her.
She's receiving the, and the same thing is true with a divorce document. She's receiving a divorce document. She's not the one who actively gives the man the divorce document. Okay, a third difference. What else?
We're not called up to the Torah.
Okay, women are not called up to the Torah. Correct. So that's part of the minyan category of things that we call dvarim shebikdusha. Things that anything that requires 10 men, women are not obligated in those things. Okay.
Women are not allowed to be witnesses.
Women being witnesses. Okay, they are. They're not witnesses in a Jewish court, correct? What else?
They don't have all the mitzvot.
Nachon, women are not obligated in all the mitzvot. Now, which mitzvot in particular are we talking about?
Mitzvot aseisha zman grama, except there are many, many exceptions.
Okay, so it's important to understand the distinction between two different categories of mitzvot. We have mitzvot that are lo taseh. When it comes to prohibited mitzvot, where it comes to negative commandments, Okay, we have two little boys who want to join our matan shiur, who should be asleep at this point in time. We're going to say a quick hello to them.
We have to go to school tomorrow.
We're going to go to sleep, yeah.
So say, where are they? Nicholas, I miss you so much.
And then we have Ariel. Ariel, say hello. Okay.
Ariel, I miss you so much.
And now they're going to go to sleep. They're just going to go right into bed and go to sleep. Okay, this is bedtime has just begun, by the way. So we're 10:30. We'll be done. These boys like staying up. Let me tell you, okay, guys, it's time to go to sleep. And it's not like at every bowl has 7 books already, by the way. Okay, let's go. Let's go into bed, boys. Let's go. Okay. So where are we on our list here? Where are we on our list?
Testimony in court.
And not obligated in all the mitzvot.
Okay, so women are not obligated in all the mitzvot. So when it comes to negative commandments, women are obligated. When it comes to positive commandments, we distinguish between time-bound mitzvot and non-time-bound mitzvot. So what's an example of a time-bound mitzvah? Let's say tefillin. Tefillin needs to be worn each day from sunrise to sunset is when we wear tefillin. This is a time-bound mitzvah. Women are not obligated. And the key phrase is not obligated. It doesn't mean they're necessarily prohibited, but they're not obligated. Okay, what else? What's another example of a difference?
Hello.
Okay, Bozy, it's time to go to sleep. One. Sorry for that. Okay. Definitely entertaining, even if exhausting sometimes, these little boys. But we love him very much. Thank God. Lots to be thankful for. So, okay, any other differences that stand out in your mind, significant halachic differences?
Well, I think we don't count for a minyan also as a time-bound mitzvah, because instead we might think we have to run off to count for a minyan instead of feeding the baby, for example.
So there may be, now we're already getting to explanations why there's a difference. Some other differences, for example, by Yerusha.
I was just going to say inheritance and also identity and tribe membership and kahuna.
Okay, interesting. So women are not, don't serve as kohanim in the Beit HaMikdash.
Or Levi'im.
Although what is interesting, and you point this out correctly, that tribe membership is based on the woman, right?
No. Jewish identity is based on the woman, but tribal membership is based on the man.
Okay, fine. I thought you meant, when we talk about the tribe, are you part of the tribe, meaning are you Jewish or not? Okay, correct.
No, I meant which of the 12 tribes are you part of?
Correct. Tribe identity is based on, which Shevet identity is based on the man, but Jewish identity is based on a woman. Okay, so, and then there are all these other questions. Can a woman be a mashkiach? Can a woman be a king or a queen? Can a woman be a rabbi or a shul chairman? And there are definitely some differences that play out here and variations of the same. So
also with marriage, a woman can have one husband, but a husband can have more than one wife.
Okay, good. So another difference of...
And is this the right place to mention Yibum?
That's another difference in marriage, that a woman who's you have two brothers and one brother dies without children, she has to marry the second brother. That is another difference.
Isn't it more that the brother is obligated to marry the woman?
Correct, exactly.
And that, I think, is a bit for her protection in a way, is it not?
It is a form of protection. You have to remember that in biblical times, there were many more women floating around than men, because men died because of war, right? So this enabled a woman to have a husband, essentially, or to secure her a husband. Okay, so Yeah.
No, I say to have a home and to have food and to have someone who would provide for her. You couldn't really be a woman on your own in ancient times.
Correct. Nachon. It wasn't like living in the big city and, you know, you get an apartment on the Upper West Side or in Katamon and, you know, it wasn't, things didn't function that way. So, so what we're seeing here, now we have two fundamental questions. And these are different sides of the same coin. Fundamental question number one is whether these differences between men and women, okay, in halakha, are they sociologically based or ontological? What do I mean by that? If it's sociological, it means that if society changes, then some of these things might change as well, and they may evolve or transition or change, in which case some of these differences between men and women might be different today than they were back in the day. And maybe we shouldn't be changing them. Maybe we should be trying to change them, okay? So that's fundamental question number one. Is it a sociological difference or is it ontological? Ontological means that these differences are rooted in fundamental, unchangeable differences between men and women, okay? So this is a question, are these sociological differences or ontological differences between men and women? Which gets us to our second question, you know, to what degree can this tension between feminism and Judaism, at least Orthodox Judaism, be resolved? Okay, to what degree can we sort of try to resolve this based again on how much Judaism can and should or does evolve and change, okay? And I guess the third question is which aspects of feminism does Judaism find valuable and meaningful and embrace and support? And which aspects, you know, are sort of far beyond the, being, you know, are problematic and anathema to Jewish values? Yeah, you want to share something? Did somebody want to share something there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good. So these are the three, everybody understand the three fundamental questions?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Okay, good. So now let's jump into, let's start with Tanakh, okay? Again, the fundamental premise of this from a historical, from a halachic standpoint is that there are differences between men and women in Tanakh, okay? This doesn't need to be proven. There are many differences. We've enumerated a number of them. But can one find any feminist tendencies or feminist streaks or feminist values or women who are stepping out of the box or women who show leadership or women who sort of take on more than what might be expected or break down, this is the key way of phrasing it, who break down standard gender norms in the Bible? Are there women who play this role Tanakh and, you know, are seen in a positive sense, okay? So you know, before we get into certain halachic aspects, which we've looked at a little bit, let's look at this from a, you know, in terms of the stories and the values that emerge from the stories in Tanakh, do we see women who, you know, play very strong roles or might play roles that we might consider to be?
So
what I want to do is I want to actually explore some of these stories, okay? So we're going back to Tanakh because it's always good to have Tanakh as a basis for this discussion. So let's look at, I'm going to share the, I'm going to do screen share again. Okay, and so let's start, but even before we get to Dvorah, I thought we'd start with Miriam, okay? Yeah, what is Miriam famous for in the Torah? What does Miriam and Nevi'ah, what does she do? She sings with the women.
She saves her baby brother, for starters.
So first of all, Miriam saves her baby brother. That's number one. She saves
actually Moshe. She actually saves the population, because she said to her father, by you not staying with my mother, you're actually going to kill off all the children.
Beautiful lesson. So you're quoting from this Midrash, which is the first source. So the Midrash Agadah tells us, you know, the first pasuk of Perek Bet of Sefer Shmot tells us, Vayelech ish mi Beit Levi, vayikach et Bat Levi. A man goes from Beit Levi and goes and takes a Bat Levi. Now, where is he going? What does it mean to go? So the Midrash tells us he actually was going according to the wisdom advice of his daughter. His daughter told him, you know, he had left his wife because of the decree of Paro, and yet now he decides to go back and to take his wife back. And his daughter basically said to him, you know, hey, pops, if you divorce mom, then you're going to make the decree of Paro even worse. Not only will you stop Jewish boys from being born or you know, from living, even Jewish boys won't be able to be born. And so he goes according to his daughter's advice, and he goes back and takes his wife. And that is Miriam, okay? She takes initiative. She's really sharp. She understands the challenge of the day, okay? The challenge that the Jewish people face. We're also told later on, Miriam, HaNeviyah, she's called a Neviyah here. This is in source number two. What does she do? Achot Aharon. She takes the musical instruments in her hands, and she goes out and sings Az Yashir. She sings with the women after the after Kriyat Yam Suf. Okay, so we're seeing this is a woman who takes initiative. He's Lokachat Yuzma. This is a woman who changes the face of Jewish history. Okay, and she's celebrated for this. She is celebrated for this. She's called a Nevi'ah, and we see right here that Nevu'ah, prophecy, is not only the domain of men, but also the domain of women. Okay, this is example number one. What might be the next example in Tanakh that's which women really break ground?
Shifra and Puah against all norms do the right thing.
We haven't even left. We're actually going back now. Shifra and Puah are two women who also, again, save loads of Jewish babies. They take initiative, in the decree of Paro. It's really, the beginning of Sefer Shmot is really dominated by women leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Bat Paro is the one who saves Moshe. Again, another example of women, female heroines in the beginning of Sefer Shmot. Okay, good. And the Torah, it's important to understand the Torah celebrates this. The Torah doesn't denigrate this type of behavior. It celebrates these women taking serious leadership. Okay, what's the next story that might be?
Selofchad's
daughters. So this is around, so Selofchad's daughters, there's an interesting question by Selofchad's daughters. First of all, who are Benot Selofchad? So here we're in the third source in Bamidbar, Perech Zion. Benot Selofchad come to, they're the daughters of Selofchad, and they come to Moshe, and they say, listen, Moshe, our father died in the Midbar. He's not going to receive any inheritance. You know, what's going to happen? We, you know, and he's saying, Halacha and Pasuk Dalet here, Lama Yigarash Shem Avinu Mitoch Mishpachto? Why should our father's name be, basically omitted, be nullified from the records? Ke'en lo ben, tena lanu achuza betoch achay avinu. Give us an achuzah amongst our father's shevet. And what does Moshe do? He doesn't have an answer. Moshe goes to Hashem and says, what should we do? And Hashem says, Kain benot slofchad dovrot. Benot slofchad are correct. They're right that they should be given land, given achuzah amongst the men. And that is indeed what happens. What do we
learn from the story? There's proviso here. They have to marry within their tribe so that the land
goes. No, that didn't happen. That didn't happen until the following parasha.
Yeah,
that was an amendment to the rule.
Okay, Cain, Karen, the Marilyn, Dovrot. You're both correct. Marilyn, you're correct that they had to marry within the tribe, so they didn't get their own inheritance. They had to marry into the tribe to keep a stake in the tribe. But Karen, you're also correct. This only happens the next parak, right? It's not, or the next parasha. But what we see here? So would this be a model of feminism in Tanakh? What do you think? Yes or no?
Yeah.
What do you think, Robin? Why yes or no?
I think there are a lot of very strong women in Tanakh. What about Tamar and how she handles Yehuda?
Yes,
she's a strong. I think yes. Jewish women have always been seen as very strong. Have we been given our rights? Well, that's debatable.
Okay, so what's happening here then in this story? Is this a model, an example of feminism, yes or no?
No, it's a yeah. question of equality.
Which is feminism.
Well, do they receive equality? I'm just getting a safe with Michelle. Do they receive equality here?
No. Because women will only inherit if there are no sons.
Okay, so they don't get, we can agree they don't get full equality. Do they get some form of equality?
No, I'd say they get some form of recognition. I don't know if I'd use the word equality at all.
I agree with you, Marilyn.
But recognition they get for their strengths and for the things that they achieve, and they do achieve, and they are strong.
Yeah.
It can't actually be equality if they're the second choice when it comes to inheritance. By definition, if they always come second, then it's not equality.
Exactly. And that inheritance comes with strings attached. They have to marry within the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes.
So it's not equality, but it's a measure of recognition. I like the way Marilyn put it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think, and I think you have a little bit of both here. On the one hand, you have, it's not equality, correct. It's not equality, certainly in the modern sense, it's not equality. They still need to marry certain men. They're not getting the property for themselves. On the other hand, there's a fundamental recognition of Hashem and Moshe and the Torah in this case, that their voice should be heard, that they were correct in this situation, and that their voice is just as important as the voice of men in this situation, right? So there is.
But that wasn't their claim. Their claim was, why should our father's name be erased? They weren't standing up for themselves or for women in general. They're standing up for their father.
They're standing up for their father. Okay, so that might be an argument that, again, they are, to some degree, we could say they're perpetuating the status quo.
Okay? Yeah.
And maybe that's why their claim is received. On the other hand, their voices are being received here, in a sense. So there is, I don't want to use the word progress per se. There's a certain recognition here of a woman's voice, right? And that they are right. They're right in this situation. So it's not, again, I'm not saying it's equality. I'm not saying this would fit into, modern notions of feminism, but there definitely is something that happens here that is, there's a transformation here of their status to some degree based on their own initiative and their own leadership. Okay, let's look at another story. Let's look at Shoftim Perek Dalet, where we have the story of Dvorah. Okay, Dvorah. And what's unique about Dvorah? If you look at Pasuk Dalet here, what is unique about her status? What is she doing at this point in time?
She's judging. She's a judge.
She's a judge. She is a judge. It says explicitly they would come to her for judgment. And now, this whole story with Dvorah raises some really interesting questions about women in the judicial system, okay? In the Gemara and the Tosfot, in Masachet Nidah address this, Tosfot and Masachet Bava Kama also address this. To what degree is, can we generalize from this situation of Dvorah that women play a role in the judicial system, okay? And there are a number of different explanations for how to understand her particular situation. But we definitely see a woman playing a significant leadership role. We see her judging other people. We see her leading men to war, okay? Barak ben Avinoam. And in the same story, you also have the story of Yael, where Yael kills Sisra, right? And leads the Jewish people to salvation through her, who is it? Sorry, got my kids knocking at the door. One second. Okay. Yeah, they're getting smart. Instead of trying to bang down the door, they're knocking. They're knocking. So, we're gonna try to ignore them here. But so this is another interesting model of women having the same sort of leadership status as men. Okay, so Tosfot says maybe this is a one-off situation because she was a Nevi'ah, Tosfot also says maybe they accepted her. This was about consensus. So when there's consensus, women can play this role. Maybe she was just teaching law. She was a professor of Jewish law. She wasn't actually. There are different ways of understanding this this story. Okay.
I remember bringing this subject up with a rabbi, and he said to me, but look where Devorah was sitting. She was sitting under a tree. She was not sitting in the place of the Sanhedrin or the court of the judges.
No, I hear it. Listen, I much prefer to daven outside by the trees in nature. Sure. I don't know about you. You know, I like davening in the forest and nature. I would much, you know, so. But I've never heard that answer. But okay, you could, you know, it's the same, it's a variation of the same theme, but there's a difference here. Okay, Shmuel, let's look at Shmuel Aleph. This is the story of Chana. Chana is one of the most famous, stories in Tanakh, especially in terms of women's roles. What do we learn from the story? What happens in the story of Chana? Who could tell me?
Well, she's praying, and she's praying at outside the temple. She's gone up with her husband for one of the Shalosh Regalim, and she's bitter and miserable because she has no children, and the other wife dies. And Eli thinks she's drunk, and he chases.
Eli thinks that she's drunk. Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not drunk. I'm sort of deeply, deeply unhappy. I have no children, blah, blah, blah. And he acknowledges that she is not drunk, and he allows her to carry on praying, I think.
Yeah. And what happens ultimately? He says God will grant you your request. And what does she receive?
A boy. She receives Samuel.
She receives Shmuel. She receives a boy. Okay. Now, there are a number of things that are interesting about this story. Number one, Eli's response. Eli was the Kohen Gadol. You would think someone comes to the Beit HaMikdash, the Mishkan, to daven, he would say, wow, this is unbelievable, a woman's davening. Whereas his initial response was, wow, she must be drunk. Okay, so it teaches you about sort of the cynicism of the leadership in that time. And by the way, in the very next parak, Eli is told that he and his sons are going to, you know, cut off from the priesthood. Because they were, his sons were corrupt, but Eli also, you know, instead of embracing Chana's initiative, he pushes her away and assumes cynically that she's drunk and just having like deep religious passion. That's number one. Number two, and that's like a good lesson for us, by the way. Sometimes we see someone like really davening and they're like, oh, well, yeah, they're a little bit crazy. They're very spiritual. It's like sort of abnormal. But when we see someone with like real kavanah, we say, wow, that's really beautiful. That's a side point. But the second thing that's interesting here is that Chana becomes a model for Avodat Hashem, for tefillah on a daily basis, right? Many things that we learn about halachot of tefillah are learned from Chana. She is a model for tefillah. You shouldn't, you know, davening out loud and not davening when you're drunk and all these things are learned from the story of Chana and in Masachet Brachot Daf Lamed, Daf Kaftet Lamed. So she becomes a model for tefillah, and her tefillah, of course, is received. And one of the great leaders of the Jewish people, Shmuel, emerges from this story. And you know, we say even in tefillah on Kabbalat Shabbat, Moshe ben Aaron b'kohana v'Shmuel b'korei Shemo. So Shmuel is like right up there with Moshe and Aaron. Okay, so she is a model for tefillah. We studied the Haftarah about her on Rosh Hashanah. And the third thing that's interesting about the story is that, and this is a point that Yael Ziegler makes, which I think is interesting, that she doesn't say, hey, you know, just wait for God. She says, we have to make things happen. And she goes and davens. And it's the davening that, again, causes God's, you know, Rachmanut to come along. So we see that this is a woman taking initiative. This is a woman breaking out of, you know, typical gender role. And ultimately, she creates change. And the change is not just for her. It's far-reaching because Shmuel is born, and it affects all of the history of tefillah for the Jewish people. So this is another interesting model of of women breaking out of gender roles. And if this is celebrated. This is celebrated. This is the first parak of Sefer Shmuel. And so she is, you know, and even she receives some form of prophecy. The chapter, you know, the Eher Tefillah that she gives is sort of a, you know, there's certain prophetic elements in it as well. So this is really an interesting model. Okay, let's move on to the next one. And this is very contemporary because we're going to read about Ruth HaMoaviah.
Yeah.
Shavuot. For many of us, I mean, I love Megillat Ruth. It's a really beloved. My wife also loves it. And there's a very, very deep and beautiful, beautiful story. Now, just tell me quickly, let's just summarize the story of Ruth HaMoaviah. What tell me about her.
She was married to one of Naomi's sons, and both of the sons died, and the other daughter-in-law went back. That's why her name is Orpah, because you could only see the nape of her neck. And she decided that she would stay, and she said to Ruth, "Where you go, I go. Where your God is my God, and I will follow you to your land." So she converted to Judaism.
What else?
Not with the Rabbanut, she didn't.
not with the Rabbanut. Yeah, would she have? I saw an article a few years back, you know, in Times of Israel. Would Ruth have passed the Rabbanut's conversion test, you know? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, and it was bemoaning, reality today in Israel. But Ruth is significant in a number of ways. First of all, her commitment to Hashem and the Jewish people, and she is a model convert, and she is rewarded for this. David HaMelech, no one less than David HaMelech comes from her progeny, and so she is clearly celebrated as a heroine, and that's number one. Number two, her kindness is unparalleled. The way that her loyalty to Naomi is unparalleled. The very notion of chesed, when we think of chesed, the model for chesed is Ruth. Ruth HaMoaviah, who goes out and gathers sheaves and doesn't do this for, you know, Naomi herself. She does it, of course, for Naomi. And she's also a model of humility, of kindness, of grace. This is of graciousness. This is Ruth. But there's a third part that's really interesting to this story. And that is in Ruth Paragimel. And Ruth Paragimel, you know, on the one hand, she's this very, she's a strong character. She's a loyal character. But she's also, as we'll see, a woman of strong initiative. She's very strong-willed, okay? And she, in her own quiet way, she actually creates, you know, brings about a new reality because of her initiative. So what happens? You know, at night, Boaz is sleeping in the field. He makes a celebration, an agricultural festival, and she goes out to the field. And Naomi essentially tells her, you know, go out and meet Boaz in the field. And Naomi doesn't quite say this exactly, but she sort of says, well, maybe you should go and try to lie with, lay with Boaz. And what happens at this moment, this encounter, is really powerful because Boaz doesn't just take Ruth. He engages her in a conversation. You know, he sees her lying next to him. And in Pasuk Hey, Boaz is sort of drunk, and Naomi, you know, sort of is, you know, right there next to him, and he says,
you mean Ruth?
Excuse me, Ruth. And instead of, you know, just taking her and, you know, engaging in, you know, physical contact, he says in Pasuk Tet Vayomer Miat, he says, who are you? He engages in conversation. Sort of contrast this, Lahavdil, with, you know, take some of these dating websites today, which I don't know, maybe some of them have gone out of business, but, you know, some of these really, you know, take Tinder, for example, and I can't believe I'm quoting this in a shiur, but Tinder is all about finding, it's a website which enables one night stands, essentially, without any, you know, sort of human, non-physical human interaction. That's all gone from the relationship. It's a relationship totally devoid of any deep human connection. And you know, so, you know, that's the world that we live in today. I know the coronavirus may have stopped Tinder from doing very well. Now people actually need to talk to each other before dating. But this is Boaz saying, wait a second, who are you? He's engaging in a human conversation, you know, before engaging in physical contact. And there's something very powerful here. Now, of course, Tanakh is very terse in its words, and there's a lot you have to read into the story. And she says, Anochi Rut Amatecha. She says, I am Rut. And again, this is about a human face-to-face interaction, which we're learning from the story is, you know, is much more important than just a physical contact. And this is where he's recognizing humanity. Yeah.
Wealthy landowner.
And instead of objectifying her, he recognizes her humanity, her personhood. Now, what's interesting that also happens here, that she now says, "Ufarasta kenatecha alamatecha." Please spread your wings over amatecha ki goelata, because you are my redeemer. You have the ability to redeem me. To redeem us, my family, me and Naomi, from this situation. Now, what is she saying here? Okay. Now, according to certain commentators, she is essentially offering him. She's essentially saying, "Hey, will you please marry me? Okay, marry me." Essentially. Now, you know, the way of the world, derech eretz, the man is usually the one who proposes. This doesn't happen so often that the woman proposes. So that's number one. That's the number one form of initiative that she takes. But secondly, if you look earlier in Sefer and Megillat Rut, and this is another point that Yael Ziegler points out, you know, very, very astutely. In Megillat Rut, I'm just going to bring up Bar Ilan here. Okay. In Megillat Rut, if you go to earlier in Megillat Rut, to Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Bet. So we're looking at Bet Yud Bet. This is not on the source sheet, but let me bring it up. Okay, Bet. Okay, Bet Yud Bet. So if you go down here, this is where, I'm just highlighting this. This is where Boaz says,
you don't see it.
Can everybody see this?
No, we have the original source sheet.
Oh, interesting. Okay, one second. Let me just...
It's a different screen share.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna share another screen. Let me just bring it up. Okay, here in Pasuk Yud Bet, Bet Yud Bet Yishalem. This is Boaz speaking to Ruth. This is the previous chapter. He says, you know, God should really protect you. You're such a nice person. Yishalem Hashem Balechu Timas Kotech Shleimai Leim Hashem Lokeisa Sherbata Lachasot Tachach Kinafav. Hashem should protect you. Should give you what you need because you've come. To find cover, if you will, under his wings. Now, in the next parak, which we just read, Rut says, you're the one who's supposed to spread your wings above me. Don't wait for Hashem to do this. Boaz, you should do this. So again, she's taking initiative like Chana. She's saying, we're not just going to wait for Hashem to do this. You need to act based on Jewish. You need to be inspired by Hashem and do this, Boaz. Don't wait for Hashem to do this. And so we see again, and this again changes the trajectory of Jewish history. She marries Boaz, David HaMelech is born, et cetera, right? And then ultimately we named our son Boaz because Boaz becomes a hero, right? So Boaz becomes a hero. And I'm just bringing some personal family narrative into this. But you see that she changes the trajectory of Jewish history. So this is another example, just another example of women's leadership, of women, maybe, what's the term I want to use? Breaking maybe expected gender roles, women taking initiative, women doing something that perhaps might be perceived as out of the box. So now let's look at Esther Perek Dalid. Yeah, go on. Okay, Esther Perek Dalid. And this is the story of Esther. Okay, this is the last story we're going to look at from Tanakh tonight. Now tell me about Esther. What does she do?
She saves the Jewish people.
She saves the Jewish people. So at first she's hesitant. She's like, who am I? I haven't seen the king in a few days. He's not going to want to see me. He's not going to receive me. And Mordechai, what does he do? He challenges Esther. He says, well, what are you doing here? Why do you think God chose you in this particular role? You think it's just a sit in garden parties and drink wine and be the queen. No, you have to save the Jewish people. These are the famous lines in the Gita. And what does Esther do? Does she take up the challenge? Yes. Gather all the Jews who are in Shushan and fast for me for 3 days. Okay, and then notice, what is Megillat Esther called? Is it called Megillat Mordechai? Yeah. No, it's Megillat Esther. She at the end of Megillat Esther in Perek Yud, she's the one who encourages the writing down of Megillat Esther. This is her Megillah. This is
in Megillat Esther. We watch her go from a very obedient young girl. She did everything Mordechai told her to. The Megillah specifically says
correct.
And we watch her come into adulthood. We watch her grow a spine until she says to Mordechai, "Now you go organize all the Jews."
Correct. Nachon. Correct. So this is but another example of women taking charge, right? And so, you know, what do we, if we have to summarize based on these stories, there are other stories of women in Tanakh. These are not the only stories, but what might be the picture that emerges about Tanakh in, about women in Tanakh? What do you think?
Well, there are very strong role models and strong women in Tanakh. Rahab the prostitute is a very strong woman.
Another example,
Yafeh. Who saved Meraglim. There are. Are there as many as there are men leaders? No, there aren't. Yeah. But there are the women who stand out, and they stand out because they have the courage of their convictions and they have tremendous strength. And there are lots of them.
Now, but here's the key point. Are they denounced or are they celebrated?
Celebrated, I don't know, but they're not denounced. No, they're recognized.
Ruth, Esther, these women are not just recognized, they are celebrated.
Yeah, they're celebrated. Okay, they are.
No, you know, so I think what I think the picture that emerges from looking at Tanakh is a little bit more complex than we might have thought. There's no doubt the Torah embraces certain elements of female leadership, of women's leadership, women taking initiative. The boundaries between sort of designated roles for men and women is not so clear cut. Sometimes they cross boundaries. Sometimes it's the women who are really leading the men to war. It's the women who are judging, the women who are prophets, the women who are leading to salvation. You know, so the women who are singing, the women who, you know, who have, you know, the women in Chet HaEgel is another example. Women are the ones who didn't serve a Chet HaEgel, the golden calf. So the picture that emerges is actually more complex than, you know, men are the leaders, men are always in charge, men are the ones who tell women what to do, and women always have to take a back seat. I really don't think that's the true picture in Tanakh. I'm not saying that this is the, you know, women are always leading, but they certainly are, and they're celebrated for this. And it would be interesting, you know, can one, I'll raise this as a question, can one make the case that as Tanakh evolves, women's role gets stronger and stronger? It's an interesting question to think about.
I want to say something now. I think that men, when they want to be leaders, they don't need the courage that women do to step out of the box. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are many men who are denounced who maybe have positions of authority, but they're not considered leaders, right? I mean, there are many terrible kings, you know, Jewish kings. They're kings, but they're not celebrated. They're considered wicked, right? So just because men have authority doesn't mean that they are good, right? And I think that may be one of the messages here, that there's a distinction between having a position of authority versus being a leader. That you could have a position of authority and you could be good or wicked. And it's possible, it's probably the case that men are designated positions of authority, you know, much more than women are, no doubt. But that could be good or bad. right? That could be a good thing or a bad thing. It doesn't necessarily lead to good results. In fact, many times men are denounced for corruption and for greed and for doing terrible things, right? So it is interesting. The picture is kind of, yeah. Yeah, anything else? Did somebody want to say something? Okay, good. So this is in Tanakh. Now, I want to look at a few examples. And again, these are not necessarily even representative. These are not exclusively what appears in Tanakh. There are other sources that point in this direction. But one second, let me just open the door here. There are, but I do want to look at a few sources in Tanakh, in the Gemara, which address taking on more than what might be expected of them, or women sort of, again, taking on initiative, women, taking charge, charting new territory, entering a man's domain, breaking down gender roles. I just want to see a few examples of this that appear in the Gemara, okay? So number one, if you look in the Talmud Bavli Masachet Erev and Daf Tzadivav, we have this story of Michal Bat Kushi. This is Michal Bat Shaul. Okay, she's the daughter of Shaul. Hayta manacha tefillin. V'almichu b'chachamim. She would wear tefillin. Okay, so this is an interesting example. Women don't normally wear tefillin, which we'll talk about at some point. But this is a woman sort of breaking down your standard gender roles, and rabbis don't protest it. Okay, now we're going to look at another example in Masechet Chagiga. This is one of the earliest machlokot in all of Shas. Okay, I've given you the source in Hebrew and English. Let's read the source in English. Okay, actually, who would like to read? Chava, would you like to read this in English? The Gemara raises an objection.
Okay, the Gemara raises an objection to this from a Braita. Speak to the children of Bnei Israel. The word B'nai literally means sons of, and it states nearby, and he shall place his hand on the head of the burnt offering, from which we learn that the sons of Israel place their hands, but the daughters of Israel do not place them. Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Ishmael say...
So this is so we're talking about doing something called smicha. Smicha in the Gemara is not in Torah, is not when a person receives ordination. It's when you actually place your hands and your weight on the animal that you're sacrificing in your place. Okay, so men have to do this. The question is whether women can do this. So keep going, Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Ishmael say.
Let's say it is optional for the daughters of Israel to place the hands. They may place the hands if they so choose, although they are not obligated to do so.
Okay, keep going in English. Rabbi Yossi said.
Rabbi Yossi said, the sage Abba Elazar related to me the following incident. On one occasion, we had a calf for a peace offering, and we brought it to the women's courtyard, and women placed their hands on it. We did this not because there is an obligation of placing hands in the case of women, but in order to please the women by allowing them to sacrifice an offering in all of its particulars as men do. Now, if it enters your mind that we require placing...
Okay, this is just a continuation of the discussion about how a person does smicha with all your weight, with just, you know, generally placing your hands. But we see here in a principle... Okay, and the principle in Hebrew is kedei nachat ruach v'nashim. Kedei lasot nachat ruach v'nashim. The rabbis sort of let women engage in a mitzvah that they wouldn't normally engage in. And there might be, by the way, a prohibition involved here that it's considered a shvut. It's considered a rabbinic prohibition to do smicha on Yom Tov and you don't have to. Yet they let the women do this kedei lasot nachat ruach v'nashim to allow women to be connected to the mitzvot. Okay, so this is an interesting example of creating, a leniency so that women can be more connected to mitzvot that they're not necessarily obligated in. Okay, yeah, go on.
There is.
Okay.
Go on reading.
Now we're going to see another an example of a very dynamic woman in the Gemara. She's famous. Her name is Bruria. Okay. She's the wife. Maybe at some other point we'll study the Bruria's entire history and every story surrounding her, because she is quite a complicated legacy, which I don't want to get into right now. But there are two stories that are interesting because, you know, we see that she's breaking a mold here. Okay, So the first story, I'll just say it outside. There are these ruffians, these sort of bad, you know, gangsters in the town of Rabbi Meir. This is Gemara Masachet Brachot Daf Yud Amud Aleph. And they're really causing him a lot of pain. And so what does he do? He davens that God should kill them. So Bruria, his wife, says to him, what are you doing? What you think that you're doing is based on the pasuk. There's a pasuk that says, "Itamu chataim, urishaim orenam." So she says, well, if you read this pasuk carefully, it doesn't say "Itamu chotim." It doesn't mean we need to get rid of the sinners. We have to get rid of the sins. Okay. So instead, you should daven that these people should do tshuva. And once they do tshuva, then there won't be any sinners anymore. Meaning, don't daven. She's saying people are fundamentally good. Help them get rid of their wickedness, don't kill the sinners themselves. So this is, you know, Bruria having tremendous emotional, spiritual insight and giving it to her husband. And this is an example of a woman who, again, she doesn't have an obligation to study Torah, but clearly she's very learned. She's quoting Pesukim and specific ways of understanding this Pesukim. Okay, now we see another example. In Talmud Bavli, Erev and Daf Nun Gimel Amud Bet. Here we have Rabbi Yossi HaGalili is going on the way. Ashkache le Bruria, and he encounters Bruria, and he says to Amrla, "Beizu derech nelech laLud." He says, "What path should we take to Lud?" You know, they're walking on the path. He sees her. He says, "They seem like clearly they're both going to Lud." And he says, "How should we get to Lud?" Amrla, she says, "Galili shodesh." She says, "Galili, you fool! Lo kach amru chachamim al tarbesim chayim aisha." Hayalach alomar beizu laLud. She says, "Wait a second! Don't the rabbis teach that you shouldn't?" You shouldn't have wasteful conversation with women. Women, and you're talking to me right now. You should say, wait a second, which way to lude? You should have asked in two words instead of four words. Okay, so this is Bruria. She's playful here. She is. You know, one can read this as her scorning the rabbis, undermining them. This is Bruria, you know, sort of acting as a fifth column, in a sense, undermining rabbinic authority. There is another interpretation of the story, which I want to quote in the name of a colleague of mine, Rabbi Aryeh, just forgetting his last name for a second. Aryeh, will come up in a second. And he is actually quite an interesting interpretation of the story. Sorry, I just went off the screen. And his interpretation here is, that he's sort of, Yossi HaGalili is sort of having this pickup line for Bria. She says, well, how shall we go to, you know, Lud together? And she says, excuse me, I'm not interested in talking to you, or I'm not interested in this, you know, you sort of just assuming that we're going to go to Lud together. And that's why she brings in this big statement, well, I took basically Chaim Aisha, her pushing him away, in a sense, you know, not interested in going on a date with you, Yossi. So, you know, these are a few other examples of women breaking the mold. Bruria, except for one reading in Rashi, Bruria for the most part is celebrated in Jewish tradition. There's a school in southern New Jersey called Bruria. Women call their daughters Bruria. You know, so she does have a positive legacy in Jewish history. We see other examples of women, you know, being able to do, again, partake in sacrifices. We see Michal Bat Shaul putting on tefillin. We also have, just a few other examples. Again, we've said that women are not obligated to mitzvot, right? But what if a woman wants to perform a mitzvah? So, you know, we see a very interesting discussion that emerges in the Rishonim. And this discussion is as follows. Let's say a woman wants to shake a lulav. Can she make a bracha on this or not? She's not obligated to shake a lulav. It's a time-bound mitzvah. But can she, if she would like to, can she make a bracha just like a man does? And in this Gemara, we have a big discussion here, a big debate that's brought down in the Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, Rabbeinu Tam. And he quotes the famous Shita of Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam says, Tam, when it comes to time-bound mitzvot, that women are not obligated to kiyat shofar, lulav. Women are allowed to make a bracha, even though they're not obligated in doing these things. Okay. So what we see here is that women are mind-bound mitzvot, but there is an embracing of their performance of the mitzvot, and they're allowed to perform. Now, I'm not saying they could perform every type of mitzvah. We will talk about some that they're prohibited from doing tefillin. It's an interesting example of whether women can put on tefillin or not. But for the most part, when women perform positive commandments, they can make a mitzvah, they can make a bracha. And I will, we'll bring tonight's shiur to a close with, I'll tell you the following story, just with regards to tefillin. I taught at a high school called SAR High School. And maybe some of you heard of it. It's a yeshiva high school in Riverdale, New York. I taught there for a few years, and they had a big controversy because two girls in 11th grade at the time wanted to put on tefillin. And the school generally is a little bit more open on some of these areas. And they said yes. And no one really discussed it. It wasn't considered such a big deal in the school's community until another high school in Los Angeles, another yeshiva high school, picked this up in an article, and they wrote about it. Girls met in SAR High School, and then the whole Jewish world started debating and discussing, and it was a whole discussion. And, it took up, it was months of discussion in the school. So here's an interesting question of women who want to take on more, you know, does halakha enable them to do this? So the sources that I brought together tonight, I want to summarize everything that we've done tonight. We identify the challenges, the differences between what would appear to be a Jewish perspective on feminism and, you know, the definitely differentiation between men and women, especially in halachic areas. We have identified what the values of feminism are and why they clash with halachic Judaism. And then we started looking through Tanakh and the Gemara, and it becomes clear that the picture is more complex than one might think. There definitely is a breaking down of gender roles. There are women who are taking initiative, taking leadership roles, women who are surpassing men, women who create salvation, women who save the Jewish people. Again, it's not. There's no doubt that I don't think anyone can make the case that men and women are equal in the modern sense in Tanakh or in the Gemara. But there are definitely there's an embracing of women's commitment. The commitment, the leadership roles, ability to partake in certain.
Now, I say there are examples of special women, but if you think that 50% of the human race is male and 50% of the human race is female, there certainly aren't 50% women represented in.
Correct. 100%. Correct.
Even these stories of the woman who later fell in and all, I'm not a feminist rabbi, actually. I'm just, but you use the word, they are allowed to. In today's world, women don't want to be allowed to. They want to be independent and equal.
Independent. Nahon, 100%. Correct. I'm not trying to, let me just be very clear. I'm not trying to say that these stories, you know, are suggesting a feminist outlook and that they have the same values as feminists. I'm not trying to do that. I recognize there are significant differences here. If you look at the percentage of men who are leading in Tanakh and the percentage of women, it's very small. It's maybe 10% to 90%. And these are women who are sort of breaking barriers in a sense. Okay. And so I acknowledge that's not the same thing as having the right to do something without having to ask permission or without having to break down barriers. You know, you just are the same, have the same status as men have in society. So I'm not trying to engage in apologetics here and to try to resolve these things and say, oh, these are not really different ideologies, Judaism and feminism. All I'm saying though, is that the story in Tanakh and in Gemara, these general sources that we've seen, is more complex than, you know, Judaism is against women, you know, having any leadership or playing significant roles, or, you know, there's no doubt that I think there is a recognition of women leadership, of women initiative, of female power in a sense.
Rabbi, I would like to suggest that the Gemara, when it was redacted, was actually done at a time of politics when women didn't have a role in society. The problem is that society has moved on, but the interpretations of the Gemara by the rabbinut haven't moved on.
Okay, so that's something that we're going to continue to explore. Now, what you're assuming here, Leslie, and this goes back to the first question that I asked, are these differences, which no one's denying there are differences here, right? I'm not trying to pull blinders over anybody here. Are these differences sociological, which is what you're arguing? Hey, the Talmud was written in a certain context. Oh, this is 2,000 years ago. Women didn't get an education. Women, for whatever financial, economic reasons, needed to be in the home. Well, things are different now, and halakha should be different, right? So are these sociological, historical differences, or are they ontological, okay? And that's meaning, are they rooted in reality, or are they rooted in just historical circumstances that can be changed and should change, right? So this is one of the fundamental questions, and it's one of the fundamental fault lines. As we'll see, the answer is complicated, because it's going to be a little bit different. Certain things are fundamental. Certain things do evolve and have evolved and have changed, right? And we're going to explore that over the next few weeks. But what we're going to start with next week is, can a woman take on the status of a man entirely, 100%?
Become what?
Become a man in terms of halachic obligation. Okay, we're going to explore the most extreme possibility. Mm-hmm. Okay, that men and women have the exact same halachic obligation. And we're going to move back from there once we go to the outer edge and explore that. Okay, so that will be Bezrat Hashem next week. Now, as I mentioned in the WhatsApp, we will be returning to our regular time. 11:45 Monday morning. Okay, so I look forward to doing that. I hope on Zoom. Yeah, we're going to do unless Matan opens up, you know, we'll do it on Zoom. So
I wanted to suggest that maybe to say women are allowed to is